How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody. Happy New Year. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. I'm so glad you're with us. We're in a little bit here. Our featured author is another smart person, and I'm still reeling, and my psyche is still damaged heavily from Eugenia Chang back in December, who's an incredibly smart person who can take a simple word like math and make it really big. But we're going to talk to William Rankin, professor of history at Yale and the cartographer to the stars, world-renowned cartographer to the stars. He has this fabulous book called Radical Cartography, How Changing Our Maps Can Change the World, Our World. It's really wonderful. We are also going to have the first nomination in the pitch, in which our wonderful independent bookstores are nominating authors from their region for this competition. And these authors have books coming out in the first half of 2026. And we've got the first one up this evening with City Lights in San Francisco. We are very excited about that. But we've got a few minutes. Claude's doing the important work. Our favorite mayor, Judd Ashman, has joined us. Hi, Judd.
Hi. Great to be back. I'm great. I am not relinquishing my title, but I do want you to know that I have thrown my hat in the ring to run for higher office for Montgomery County Council.
You mentioned this a little while ago. I wanted to follow up on it, but it was crazy over the holidays. So you're mayor of the third largest city in Maryland, correct? Gaithersburg?
That is correct.
Yep. Happened to be the founder and poobah of all things important, the Gaithersburg Book Festival, which is how we met you. But how is this job bigger than being mayor of the third largest city in Gaithersburg?
Well, I mean, it's debatable whether it's bigger. I would say that the city of Gaithersburg, thankfully, is in great shape. I've been mayor for 12 years. I'm not saying it wasn't in great shape before I got there. I've kept it in great shape with a wonderful group on the council. But the county needs help. They need a sort of a more pragmatic voice. And so I can't really look myself in the mirror and just let it go. So that's really my impetus. But I'm still mayor at least until November, and we'll see if I win or not. And until then, I hope to remain the favorite mayor of this show.
Always, forever and ever, ever, in perpetuity.
And by the way, Gaithersburg consistently ranked by WalletHub one of the most diverse cities in America. Okay,
that is correct.
That's what Mayor Judd is doing: the book festival and diversity.
Yeah.
I would love to see one of Bill's maps of Gaithersburg. It would be all kinds of colors. I'll tell you that.
think about the things that happened in your 12 years, Judd. I think about the pandemic, obviously. A lot has happened in 12 years.
Yeah, and from the time I was on the city council, I was a city council member for 7 years before that. So I've been through the Great Recession. I've been through government shutdowns. I've been through the pandemic. Yeah.
And through it all, you've continued to grow the book festival. May 16th this year?
May 16th.
Okay. Remind us how wonderful it is and about the free parking.
It is... it's the largest book and author event in the state of Maryland. It is free to attend and free to park. I would give you a whole list of authors, but we don't have them all lined up yet.
We'll do that coming soon.
Yeah, we're working on it. We have some lined up. You can go to the website, GaithersburgBookFestival.org, and see some. Meg Cabot, who wrote Princess Diaries, Jonathan Carl, White House correspondent. Linda Sue Park, legendary children's author. We have a bunch so far, but there's many more to come. So keep an eye on the website.
And we'll have you back on to talk about it again, but I'll say it now. Yeah. Put May 16th, if you're anywhere in the DMV or just love books, put it on your calendar. It is such a fun event. The diversity of events, activities is insane. Whatever you want, it is insane. So it's really
fun. The children's section is really, really fun too.
Children's section is great.
Yeah, oh my gosh. Yeah.
And the used book section. I always think the people who come to book festivals, don't they have enough books? But no, they swarm over that tent. It's the last.
What's better than getting a great book for like $2?
They do it. They love it. Okay. All right. Elaine, Ray, are you ready to chat?
Sure.
All right. Elaine Katzenberger, welcome to Chat on Books. Thank you so much for joining us. We want to chat with you a little bit about the bookstore. City Lights is iconic. among, I mean, there's so many fabulous bookstores across the country, and we're really getting to know some of them. But City Lights is really, really iconic. Almost 75 years, I'm thinking. Was it 1953 it was started?
That's right, 1953. So,
Yeah. Well, thank you for being with us, and thank you for being part of the pitch. But tell us a little bit about the store. And you guys don't just sell books, you publish books. And then I'll have you introduce Ray, and we'll talk to her about her fabulous book.
that's right. So, City Lights was founded by poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti. He's most people, if they would know Lawrence's work, would know his book, A Coney Island of the Mind. It's really a beloved poetry book. I think it still is the best-selling American poetry book of all time.
Wow.
So Lawrence is a figure in and of himself, and Lawrence founded the bookstore in 1953, in the same place where City Lights still is in North Beach in San Francisco. We've expanded to fill the entire building over the years. It started out in a very small little sort of pie-shaped triangle in this quirky building. He started it with another man who had a magazine at the time. It was a literary magazine called City Lights. And Lawrence had submitted some translations of his. And so they already had an acquaintance with each other. And then when this guy was going to start this little pocket bookshop, Lawrence happened to be driving by and just stopped in to say hello. And that led to them becoming partners. The whole idea of the bookstore at the time was to support this publishing effort. And it was like, okay, well, this is a practical way we can do this more less practical thing we want to do. And so Lawrence always had a publishing side of things in his mind. And in 1955, he launched City Lights Publishers. And the first book of ours was his first book to be published, called Pictures of the Gone World, which was number one in City Lights Pocket Poet series, which became our sort of foundational series. And that's still ongoing today.
I apologize for interrupting, but starting your own publishing house in that era must have been really gutsy, right? I mean, the big publishing houses were big publishing houses, and to say we can do this, pretty gutsy.
Well, I think it always is. I don't think that's changed. So, yeah. And I think, to hear Lawrence tell it back over the years, part of what I think he sensed was actually a sense of freedom from not being in New York. He had been in New York working in, I think it was magazines first, just as, sort of checking things out. And he came west and really felt like, there was a lot of freedom and openness, not just of ideas, but also just space to operate out here in a different way that wasn't these big corporate monoliths that already were extant at the time. So, but it started out very small, and it became very famous and was put on the map when Lawrence published Allen Ginsberg's Howl, and that was his fourth
A
book.
good
And
one.
that book went to court, and he had to defend it against obscenity charges. He risked his business in order to publish and sell that book, and that is pretty much what made Lawrence and City Lights famous for the things that it remains key to our identity and our mission. It's about sort of a defense of free speech and free inquiry and critical thinking, and not really bowing to the sort of social mores that might dictate what you can say and do. So,
Which
yeah.
we're big fans of here. Really hard to have any kind of independent bookstore survive and thrive over the years.
That's
Is
right.
that the secret sauce? What you were just talking about? Is that the secret sauce? I mean, I used to spend a lot of time in San Francisco. The city's taken some knocks over the last, say, 10, 15 years. Is that what keeps it
It's
going?
taken a lot of media knocks, that's for sure. No, I mean, City Lights, it became famous. And so that has definitely helped. And San Francisco is a city that draws a lot of people, tourists from all over the country and all over the globe. And it became a destination, not for all tourists, but for those who are interested in literature. It was that, and also the curation of the store, I think, and the publishing house. Lawrence's publishing acumen was really quite good. And he, continued to publish international authors and all kinds of books that I think establish City Lights as a very important voice, not just in poetry, but in literature in general. And so those things helped our reputation as a bookstore as well. And being a destination in a destination town definitely is a huge ace in the hole for us. So, yeah.
In the course of putting together this competition, starting to get to know some of your colleagues at different stores around the country. And you know how some people decide they want to go, Judd and Claude be familiar. All the guys always want to go to every Major League Baseball park in the country. Like they decide that's the right. There are, you could do it in every state, but there are some of these bookstores where if you're going to be in that part of the country, go to that store because you'll learn more about the community. You'll learn more about what's going on in that town, in that area than any other way you could do it. Okay.
I'm the bookstore guy, more than the baseball stadium guy. I'm the bookstore guy.
So when you're traveling, Judd, you go, what's the local? I do too. Yeah. And I
Yeah,
annoy the heck
absolutely.
out of them asking questions. How long have you been here? What's selling? Yeah. Okay. All right. Elaine, thank you again. Thank you so much. Please introduce us to our first nominee in the pitch, Ray Alexandra, which we're thrilled to meet and hear about her book.
Well, I'm
I'm
going to
thrilled
let
to be
Ray
here.
tell us a little bit more, but Ray is a journalist at KQED, our local public radio station, really also has a big long history. And I just want to say, Ray's book came to us through her own sort of what to call it, not samizdat, but sort of publishing efforts on her own. She started making little zines out of this wonderful series that she started on KQED and was placing them around in various locales, and one of them was City Lights. And we just noticed them and thought, wow, what is this? This is really, really cool, these stories of these women. And so we reached out to Ray and talked about how do we maybe make this into a book? What else you got? And that was the beginning of this project. So I'll let you take it from here, Ray.
Pretty
Again,
great.
I had massive imposter syndrome because it's City Lights.
Okay, Ray, very quickly before we talk about the book, born and raised in Wales, worked in the UK, came to the States. What did you want to be when you were five? What's the backstory?
When I
Oh,
was
and
a
who's
kid,
that just came onto the screen?
I have 12,000 cats, and keeping them off me right now is very challenging. But yeah, I came out to San Francisco in 2002. I had been a music journalist for a couple of years at that point. My background was in music journalism, specifically punk and hardcore, which is one of the reasons City Lights was one of the first places I ever went when I visited San Francisco in the 90s, because they had a background in that scene in the 70s, being in North Beach. The book is born from a weird combination of being obsessed with San Francisco history and also having a very DIY feminist punk rock background.
There you go. So, unsung heroines, it's really the untold stories. Maybe just pick two or three of the stories, the vignettes from the book that you really responded to the most, that you really loved the most.
So the book became a book after 7 years of writing essays about women who'd been written out of history in the Bay Area. And it was only supposed to be five essays for Women's History Month for KQED as part of a series that was called Rebel Girls. And then it escalated and it kept going and it kept going and it kept going because I kept finding these incredible women who nobody knew about and I didn't know about. And I was wondering, like, why don't we know these women's names? One of the first ones that I wrote, and one of the ones that really sticks with me as somebody who we absolutely should know, not just in the Bay Area, but as a nation, is a woman named Charlotte L. Brown. And Charlotte L. Brown was a Black woman living in San Francisco. It was 2 years before slavery had even been abolished. And one day she boarded a streetcar. She had an appointment somewhere, and the conductor asked her to leave. And she said, "Well, no, here's my ticket." And he said, "There's white women in this carriage. You need to get out." So he forcibly removed her. And then after that happened, she went home. She spoke with her father. He was formerly enslaved, but he was also a co-founder of the Bay Area's first Black newspaper in the 1860s. And together they took the Omnibus Railroad Company to court. And after a very long battle, they won.
And she won kind of a sizable settlement because they just wouldn't let it, they just wouldn't drop it. But obviously, this is 100 years before Rosa Parks. This was 3 years before Mary Ellen Pleasant took her case for similar reasons to the California Supreme Court. And I think Charlotte L. Brown was really a leader in anti-segregation, and yet nobody knows who she is.
Yeah. I think it's okay, and I'll do this very, very quickly because I'm being respectful of everybody's time. I think there's sometimes a thing with California, and Elaine, you mentioned something earlier, made me think about this. The conventional media tends to treat California as San Francisco, LA, and it's so much about big political issues that you lose a lot of what's going on in California. And again, I keep saying untold stories, the stories of these women who had huge impacts, whether it was segregation or public toilets, or I mean, the list goes on and on and on, voting by mail, all sorts of things. These stories, they really transformed the state, that part of the state and the state. And it's just an interesting thing about how the rest of the world treats California. So I'm so glad you brought some of these stories forward. They're fantastic.
Well, also there's an idea, and I was guilty of this before I started the series. The thing that spurred me to start it was finding out that only 12% of buildings, parks, streets, statues, etc. in San Francisco were for women. And I was infuriated because I thought, this is San Francisco. We're supposed to be better than this. Like, what happened? If it's this bad here, how bad is it everywhere else?
Well, have you been in Statuary Hall in the United States Congress?
I don't. Oh God.
It's not so
It's
different.
great
Yeah,
point.
it's this is this idea that in California we're somehow we have a much kinder history in terms of civil rights issues and such. And in the course of writing this series, I realized we really didn't in many cases.
But your book will help. It will
I
help.
hope so.
Okay, Elaine, take us out with this. You have so many terrific authors in that part of the world. There are so many authors' books you could have picked. What caused you to say want to nominate Ray for this, for the pitch, for the competition?
This book is really exciting and it's really accessible. The essays are short. They're very digestible. You learn a lot about each woman. There's a wonderful illustration of each woman that's based on most of them. There are photo a lot of these are historical figures. Some it comes up to the present. But so you get a very personal view. And again, I think also there is a personal view in each one of these essays too that makes them a very real person. It's not just the things that they did to uplift a community or to better a social situation, but it's also like they're, if they're a mom or they're a sister or a mother or whoever they are, that's in there too. And so I think that there's a way in which each one of these is a very realistic role model for any one of us at this stage. And right now, uplifting stories of people who just regular people who made a difference in their community, there, I mean, we really need that. So I, for those reasons, and I'm just excited about this book. It's about to come out. Ray's done a great job. It's been really fun making it. We're about to get the first books from the printer. It's,
Fabulous. Thank you for nominating it. Ray, thank you for the work. Thank you for producing the book, and we will be back to you soon, okay?
thank you so much.
Thanks to you
Yeah,
both.
unsung
Thanks for having
heroine.
us. Unsung Heroines, it's
Yeah.
fabulous. I've read it. It's fabulous. Okay, say hi to the cat. Okay, Bill Rankin, you ready?
I am ready. Yes.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to Chatter.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Do we find you downtown New Haven, Connecticut?
I am in downtown New Haven. That's right.
Oh, probably really cold and nasty. Okay, Bill, you said we could call you Bill. Say hi to
Yeah.
Claude and to Judd. And you're going to have to really humor us here and bring this book down to the level, Radical Cartography, that we can understand. I don't know if you've ever met, you should meet Eugenia Cheng, who writes these incredibly best-selling books about math. But
Yeah,
she
great.
does it in such a way that you can actually understand it.
Sure.
Similarly, you operate at this level, so we got to come to this level. But give us your backstory. I've read a little bit. You started out headed for architecture. Then you kind of morph into the history of science and architecture, but then you become this award-winning, world-renowned cartographer. How does that happen?
Yeah, so I did start, I started out in architecture, design school. And thought I was going to be an architect.
What did you want to build?
I mean, I don't know if I got that far. I just had this idea that I wanted to build stuff, right? I wanted to design
Okay.
stuff. I wanted to be the
Were
one
you a
design that,
Legos
right?
kid,
I was a
Lincoln Logs?
Legos kid. I was a,
Okay.
you know, I was bored in the restaurant. I'm gonna turn the placemat over and draw, you know, a new city kind of kid.
Yeah.
I was the follow along. I was also the follow along in the back seat with the Road Atlas kid also.
Nice.
So yeah, and for me it was really a kind of imagination, kind of world making. And it was through drawing, through you know, putting stuff on the wall, talking about it. It was about seeing, you know, even just walking around. I went to school in Houston, walking around Houston and seeing things in a different way, seeing the potential and kind of weird neglected sites, things like that. But yeah, then I sort of took a left turn and went into history, history of science. And I didn't think that I would be studying maps at all. But maps were just, they became something that I kind of did in my spare time. They were a kind of holdover from my design education. They were a way for me to understand. So I grew up in Chicago, went to school in Houston, then I was in Boston for grad school. And it was a city that made no sense to me. I was trying to get my head around it. And mapping became the way that I just started to explore Boston.
Okay, I read somewhere online, so it must be true, that you really got into mapping because you found Boston confusing and hard to get
Yeah,
around.
that's right. That's right.
So you just sit down one day and say, I'm going to make a map of Boston?
And more or less, yeah. I mean, I was interested in these. The Boston is, you know, these squares, right? They're
Yeah.
not really squares; they're intersections. And there's a sort of jumble of these squares all around, and they're connected by these various streets. It's a bit of a jumble. And I was working actually in a lab at MIT at the time, and so I went to the MIT library. And found a bunch of old maps of Boston that were based more around the squares than the, you know, the current maps were. And those made a little more sense to me. Like I got a sense of how Boston was put
Right.
together.
Okay.
And yeah, I started making my own maps really by kind of just tracing over old ones, taking photos, putting them in the computer, tracing them over them, you know, with the software. So I didn't start out as a kind of you know, map head. I wasn't like a data junkie. I was a sort of, I want to understand this place a little better. Another thing that was, I think, part of that was talking to people that I knew. People would talk about how white Boston was. And I just didn't seem true. And it was, I think, because Boston is made up of sort of little islands.
Yes.
And I kind of got interested in this idea that, you know, people had such different experiences of the city. And they understood it in such different ways. And the idea that someone can live their whole life in Boston thinking Boston's a really white place. And I would do a lot of cycling around, and it was very clear this was wrong. And so the mapping again became a way of kind of testing some of the conventional wisdom, trying to understand the city better, trying to understand how my relationship to the city. So it really started as a kind of personal thing.
From the standpoint of what the original maps were missing, I mean the streets were in the right place, the bodies of water were in the right place, but what was missing was something about the people who were living, sort of who was populating the different parts.
Yeah, it
Am
was
I?
the people. Yeah, the people were missing. Absolutely. And it was not just the people, but something about the people and the neighborhoods that they, you know, were part of, and how the experience of being there. So I really wanted to understand the city better. And I wanted to see the city not just as a collection of streets and coastlines and infrastructure, but to see it as a collection of neighborhoods, of people, of communities. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's right.
Okay, I don't want to put words in your mouth, and by the way, your words will be far better than mine. But I want you to tell us the essence of radical cartography. But again, going back to Eugenia Cheng, which was fascinating, because most people think of math as literal, factual. It's just the truth,
That's
and
right.
she turns that upside down and goes, no, really, it's about a lot of different things, and it can be very subjective, and it should be. And she's kind of challenging the status quo. And similarly, I think in this book, I think most people think of maps as just, okay, here are lines, here are boundaries, here are borders, this is what it is. And you're saying it's about much more than that, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I think the essence of it is that maps can be totally accurate. and also totally misleading at the same time. And so you take a map of a city. I grew up in Chicago, so I've looked at a lot of maps of Chicago. A map of the neighborhoods of Chicago, a demographic map of race in Chicago, for example. And you have all these neighborhoods that are these solid colored shapes with clear boundaries. And this is a black neighborhood, this is a Hispanic neighborhood, this is a white neighborhood. And the map is basically telling us that the city is made up of these really tidy shapes. And inside that shape, everyone is of the same, background. And then you have a stark transition to another neighborhood on the other side of this railway line or street or whatever it is. And that's not right. So it's an accurate way of showing the data. The data is collected by block or by census tract or whatever, and you can represent it. And it's not like the colors are wrong, but that's not actually how the city works. And so a lot of what I've been trying to do is to say, okay, how do we make different kinds of maps that don't bake those kinds of assumptions into what we see? So how do we see neighborhoods not as these, hard-edged shapes, but as more fluid? How do we see places that instead of seeing a shape that's, a single color making a certain claim about homogeneity or uniformity within that place. So how do we break that apart and say, oh, there's not just one thing going on here. There's many different things going on here. So that's a lot of what it is to say, how do we kind of ask more of our maps? How do we get our maps not to tell us simple stories of easy transitions and simple shapes, but really to say, how do we have the maps that do more to capture the world as we actually experience it. That actually, yeah.
This from the book, Radical Cartography. Every time you mention the name of the book on a podcast, there's a sale. So that's why we do this.
That's great.
Tell us about Lincoln's map. That was
So
fascinating. Fascinating.
So Abraham Lincoln had a favorite map. And this was a map that showed slavery according to the 1860 census. And he used this map all the time. He drug it around with him at the White House. He used it to track troop movements and kind of plot where his generals would go. And this was so is important and famous map, not just because Abraham Lincoln liked it and used it. It was also the one of the very first statistical maps ever created in the United States. And so it's a kind of, it's a famous map in US history. It's an important map. And
Kind of uncertain why it was created, right? Or
yeah, so
why.
it was shrouded in mystery, exactly. And nobody knew who made it or really why or how it ended up in Lincoln's hands. And different people have, historians have worked on it over the years. And different people have attributed to different authors. So I dug into it some more, and I think I finally figured out who actually was the author of it. But they didn't put their name on it. It seems to sort of travel through back channels. It was what I also noticed about it was that this is a map that shades every county a certain shade of gray based on the percent of the population that was enslaved. And you look at the map that way, and it really shows slavery really being most concentrated in the Deep South, the places where the Emancipation Proclamation
Which would
was being
seem
made.
obvious to a lot of people.
Which is how I always understood the geography of slavery. But that's not the only way you can show that data. So if you show it instead just by number of enslaved, population density, people per square mile, you actually see way more enslaved in the border states. Kentucky, Virginia, even Missouri. And just that simple way of showing the same data in two different ways, you get a really different sense of the geography of slavery. And I was looking through some of the notes about how Abraham Lincoln used the map, and he was using the map in a way that actually didn't make sense. He was saying, oh, well, like in order to free the most slaves, we direct our troops to the places that are the darkest. But that's not true. You want to direct your troops or whatever to the places that have the most people, which are usually the cities, which are not the darkest places on the map. It was this interesting example for me of a really famous and important map that showed the world in a way that was, again, accurate, but also a bit misleading. We have a really clear sense of how Lincoln himself used it, and he used it in a way that actually, was himself misled by how the map was
Yeah.
showing slavery.
And you think about how he was heavily, heavily involved in, not that he was dictating to, Grant and other military what to do, and what, but he was heavily involved. And you think how it might have changed his thinking
That's
on
right.
the execution of that war is pretty profound. Okay. So many questions, Judd. Interrupt me, because I will just like
Okay,
keep
I'm
going.
I'll interrupt you right now.
Okay, go.
I'm kind of curious, Bill, whether you have strong opinions about the practical use of how the maps are used, or is it the process and approach to mapping? Because as mayor of a city, we use GIS, geographical information system maps to visualize lots of things like race and income and crime and police calls for service so we can help. It helps us allocate our resources. Those are applications. It makes me very curious about what you sort of see if you think about the future applications for how people would use data visualization maps like yours.
It's a great question.
That's a great question. I think there's a couple of things. I think one is to think about where the data is coming from, and what kind of data is not being collected. There's a lot of questions about, the data that's easiest to collect becomes the data that we pay most attention to, even though it's not really the data we most want. And so to really think about, whose voices are being represented here and whose voices are being left out. As much as maps can show us stuff, maps are also hiding stuff. We know there's infinite number of maps we could be map making and we're not. So I think that's step one, is to think about, what's the data that comes to your desk in the first place. And then I think with a lot of the stuff you talked about, I think that there's ways that the GIS software will kind of default to showing the world in a certain way, often with kind of these clean shapes that I mentioned, or sometimes with like the just lots of little dots everywhere, like the little pins on a Google map, that kind of stuff.
Sure, sure.
And those things can really direct your thinking really strongly. And so if you have, a big shape that's a bright red color, but it only has a few people in it, you might pay attention more to that than you would to the more populated area that with all the pins that are overlapping, and so you can't really understand how many there are there in the first place, right? So I would say that GIS is hugely important for the kind of day-to-day governance of spatial things, like you're saying, everything from police to education to voting, all sorts of stuff. And we're often letting the software kind of make decisions for us about how best to understand the world. And sometimes the software it does it in a way that makes sense. Often I think it doesn't. And it's just doing it the kind of the way that it's been inherited, or the easiest computationally. So I do think that there's really something to say about thinking differently about the kinds of graphics that just fall out of the programs.
I love
We
this.
just
This
need
is
people like
so
you.
outside the box. Go, Claude.
Oh yeah, so I was born and raised in D.C., grew up in D.C., and so many times, it's a city where a lot of people come in and out. And when they come to D.C., so many people around the country, and even when I travel outside, they think of D.C. only as like Capitol Hill. But it's so much more than Capitol Hill, with different communities, different neighborhoods, and things like that. Have you seen a lot of cities that are kind of misrepresented, or there's some disparity between like the reality of like what it is versus what people think? Because they come in and they think that DC is just full of congressmen, White House staffers, all the other kind of stuff. And it's like, no, there are actually people who are born here, raised here, and it's totally different than what you may think.
I see that all the time, and I think a lot of it. I mean, there's differences, city to city, but I think one thing that I see in a lot of cases is exactly what you're talking about, that the main way people understand the city, the main way the city is represented in maps or guidebooks or whatever, is just pretty small region. And you zoom out and you see a city in a totally different way. And so, Manhattan becomes all of New York. Downtown Chicago is all of Chicago, or Sunset Strip is all of Greater Los Angeles. And so some of it is as simple as just zooming out. I do also think that there's lots of ways that different cities have different things that make them tick. And in terms of the maps that get made, like, just even just going into Google Maps, it shows every place in the world the same, using the same graphics. So you can go to Phoenix, you can go to DC, you can go to Paris, and they're all using the same kinds of lines and shapes and colors, right? I did a project for Phoenix that's in the book, and the prompt, this is, I was invited by the University of Arizona to come and kind of rethink about how to map deserts. And what I ended up with was really trying to think, okay, the issues in Phoenix are really different than the issues in other cities. How do we make a map that really shows what's important in Phoenix? And a lot of that was, land management in the desert. A lot of that was age segregation. Phoenix is, has a reputation for being a place for retirees. But really what it is that there's these huge parts of the city that people only over the age of 50 to 55 are allowed to live. And so you actually, it's not that the city as a whole has the same kind of age distribution as most any other city in the United States, but it's radically segregated by age. So you have places that are much older and other neighborhoods that are much, much younger. And so I wanted to make maps of Phoenix that really highlighted the things that were important and going on in Phoenix. And so I know DC less well, but I would imagine the same sort of thing, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's almost reverse engineering. It's
Yeah,
almost,
I like
yeah,
that.
instead of just saying, oh, this is what a map is, and with this will we map. Okay. All right. We gotta want to be really respectful of time, but I want to get you out with this on the book, Radical Cartography. We're gonna keep you for a couple other things, but the subhead of your book, which I really like, and I usually don't like subheads, is how changing our maps can change our world. And you list among your thesis, you list uncertainty, subjectivity, and multiplicity as the values you propose for cartography in the 21st century. Which one, if you can pick one, is most important to changing our world and how we perceive the world around us and why?
I think for me the most important is going to be multiplicity. I think which just means like showing the same place in different ways at once. And so many times I see a tendency, everyone from not just professional map makers, but everyday people, they want to find the one map that gets it all right. So I get asked all the time, like, what's the map I should put on my kid's wall? What's the map I should give to my friends for a present? What's the map I should use when I go to this city? And my answer is always going to be some version of why one map? Like, you got to have different maps to show different things in different ways, made by different people for different reasons. And you want those maps to also not just show, the world flattened into single numbers. You want to show all the different stuff going on in a single place. So I think to me that's the main thing, and it's both about just literally having different maps,
Sure.
showing different things,
Different, it's
and to
and it's
have and to
different.
ask those maps to show us the world that's a bit more, I don't know, maybe chaotic, a little bit more. There's more things going on in one place than just one thing, right?
More perspectives and challenging the status quo. Okay, Judd, does this help you think as a public servant? God bless you. Does this help you think about different ways of looking at these kinds of things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as Bill's talking, I'm thinking, well, what is the perfect map? The perfect set of maps is a thing that tells the story of a place. It tells what the place is, where the things are, but also the story of a place. I would love to have such things of Gaithersburg and of soon to be the District 3 of Montgomery County. Absolutely. I love that. Bill, I hope you'll come and do a project for us.
Okay. All right, Bill, I love that you came on early so you could hear from Elaine and Ray talking about The Pitch, which is all about these fabulous writers around the country nominated by stores. But we're big on independent bookstores, and I have been in the bookstore that is one of your favorites right there in New Haven. So tell us about Atticus Books.
Yeah, so Atticus Books,
50 years, right? It's they just hit their 50th birthday, I
I
think.
think that's right. I don't know the history of it actually. But it's in the bottom of the first floor of this the British art collection. The building I think was probably made about 50 years ago. So that seems right. I think there's a few things I like about it. One, independent bookstores are having a tough time everywhere. And so they're doing a lot of the stuff that I've seen elsewhere, but they're doing it really well, which is that now they've got half the square footage is bookstore, half the square footage is cafe. But you're kind of when you're there, you're surrounded by the books. They have kind of really well curated, but kind of small sections. It's not a kind of vault-like space. It's more of a sort of you go in and there's the one display for, kids' books or the one display for U.S. history. And I think they just do a really good job of finding books that people, might not know about or worth reading. So it's a, one of it's a rare bookstore where I go in and within 10 minutes I see a couple of books that catch my eye.
That you really want. Yeah.
Yeah,
I
it's
think
really
they
great.
may, I think Atticus book, I'm in, and it's like hanging out in too many bars in New Haven that I spent too much time in New Haven. But I think it might have been one of the first ones that said, okay, we're going to have coffee and food. I
Yeah,
think
that's
that
right.
might be one of the
Okay.
breakthrough moments for them. God
Yeah.
bless.
But
Okay.
I realized that they might have done that as a way to keep going, but they just make a really wonderful space. I mean, they actually done a really nice job. It doesn't seem like an afterthought. Yeah.
Yeah, Claude and John and I have talked about this a lot, and just the whole thing about independent bookstores before the pandemic. And we started doing the show, and you're talking to people at bookstores, and we taped some live shows in bookstores, and you realized that they were important members of the community, and they were gathering places, and people really liked it. And my theory at the time was it was a little bit of a reaction to so much technology in our lives, and people wanted human connections, right? The pandemic hit, devastating for a lot of them, but the ones that have survived, like Atticus, they increasingly are again really important members of the community. The number of events that these bookstores hold, they
Yeah.
have, multiple book clubs, they have author events, of course, they have things for kids, they have things for adults, they have things for senior citizens. It's they provide such an important community role, which I think is so huge right now.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
we'll send
I mean,
an
I that's right. I went there with my kids when they were first getting
yeah.
their own books. I go there when I want to get greeting cards that are sort of, quirkier and,
Yeah.
handmade kinds of stuff. I go there when I want to shop.
Socks. They
Yeah.
seem the independent bookstores seem very big on selling cute book kind of themed socks. Okay. All right. Especially since David Autors is here, we're going to subject you to 60 seconds more because this is how Claude and I make millions on Patreon. Are you ready?
Millions.
I'm ready. I'm ready.
Okay. Bill Rankin, author of Radical Cartography, which is fabulous.
Hey, Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So, download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
Okay, the book is Radical Cartography. It's flying off the shelves at Atticus Bookstore. Is that what you told me, Bill?
Yeah,
The
I've had
email?
several people told me they bought the last copy,
Oh, that's what you want to
which
hear.
I when I first heard that I was a little sad. When I heard it for the third time, I was excited.
Yeah, I mean this with the highest praise. It's really fun. It is really, really fun. I highly annoyed friends and relatives as I was reading it, going, oh, wait a minute, do you guys know this? And showing them pictures. But thank you so much for writing it. Thank you for joining us, everybody. Claude, Judd, great to see you guys. We are back in 2 weeks with Mark Medley, who is, this is a fascinating guy. He is a husband, a father, a pastor, a teacher, an author. We have a lot of, like Claude lately, a lot of like former ministers and former nuns, which is interesting.
Former
Recording
seems
artists.
to be the key word, and
Yeah,
we'll talk
very
about
interesting. He
that
is going to be talking about Live to See the Day, impossible goals, imaginable futures. And I just thought, start of the new year, he was a good one to have on. In the
later.
meantime, everybody, thank you for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks. We're out.